I'm Christy Harvey, editor of MikeCheckRadio.org and your co-host for today's edition of The Progressive Beat. Coming up on today's show, first, my co-host John Neuer and I take you into a heated debate over the pros and cons of something called strategic redeployment. Some people have said that it could take two or more years to withdraw our troops from Iraq, but other experts say it's not only possible, but necessary to conduct a safe and responsible redeployment of U.S. forces from Iraq in just 10 months.
And I'm John Neuer, and I'll sit down with Tanya Paperny, Advocacy Associate for Campus Progress, to talk about the power of the youth vote in 2008 and what Campus Progress and Campus Progress Action is doing to give a voice to issues that matter most to young voters.
And we also have our weekly campaign trivia contest. This week's is for the ladies. But first, some headlines. Leading the news this morning on all of your top papers is the news that Russia has ordered a halt to its invasion of nearby Georgia. The president of Russia has now said that it has achieved its military goals during these past 5 days of intensive fighting, and that while the troops will not be pulling out, that the fighting itself will have stopped. Next, the Washington Post has a top story that honestly could affect the world as we know it. Here's the deal. The Bush White House has now proposed a new regulatory overhaul of the Endangered Species Act. What they'd like to do is they want to allow federal agencies to decide for themselves whether protected species would be imperiled by their own agency's projects. Basically, this would remove the independent scientific review that has been required up until now to see if an agency's actions would harm or hurt polar bears or spotted owls or other endangered species. This would just trust the agencies to make the right decision. Also, here's something that might get your blood boiling. Top of ABC News today, did you know that two-thirds of U.S. corporations avoid taxes, don't pay income taxes whatsoever? It's a new study by the Government Accountability Office. It's coming out this afternoon, and it says also 68% of foreign companies doing business in the U.S. also avoid corporate taxes. So come this April, when you're signing over half of your bank account to Uncle Sam, keep in mind that it's just you. And finally, after swimmer Michael Phelps won his third gold medal in the Beijing Olympics last night, MSNBC this morning asks the question, and I quote, "In all of history, more than a century's worth, isn't Phelps now the greatest of all the great American athletes?" It's a viable question. He's now tied with four other athletes, including Mark Spitz, for the most career golds. And he now has three gold medals in Beijing, five more, and he tops Mark Spitz, who won seven in Munich in 1972. So there's the headlines. Coming up next, we go into a food fight over whether or not the new plan to redeploy from Iraq quickly and safely is the right way to go. Recently, the Prime Minister of Iraq called for a phased U.S. troop withdrawal. The United States itself says we're not going to be there forever. We will have to bring our troops home at some point. Yet there remains a significant disagreement and a lot of confusion about how much time is necessary to withdraw all U.S. forces from Iraq. This week, the Center for American Progress hosted an event to release an updated version of the report, How to Redeploy, Implementing a Responsible Drawdown of U.S. Forces in Iraq. We've got the audio from that event. The three voices you will be hearing are Lawrence Korb, he's a senior fellow for the Center for American Progress; Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel, he's from the U.S. Army, he's retired and a senior fellow at the Center for the New American Security; and finally, Colonel T.X. Hams, he's from the United States Marine Corps, also retired. The three gentlemen did not agree very much, so it's quite a heated debate about the concept of strategic redeployment. We go there now.
Let me start by saying that the subject of a withdrawal date has become very, very critical all of a sudden, because with the new Status of Forces Agreement, the Iraqis are asking to set a timeline for the United States to withdraw. According to press reports, the original position of the Iraqis was that we should withdraw in 12 months. They're talking about now maybe longer than that. During the visit of the last congressional delegation, Prime Minister Maliki talked about 16 months. Now, since for the last 3 years, we at the center have been arguing that it's time to start a strategic redeployment from Iraq. My co-author Brian Katulis and I first put out our first report back in September 2005. People raised two questions about it. Was it timely? And the other is, could you do it in a reasonable manner in a short period of time? So let me spend a few seconds talking about both of those. One, would it be good for our security? And number two, can it be done quickly and safely? Now, in our report, we argue that it can be done in 8 to 10 months quickly and safely. A year ago, when you had about 30,000 more troops there, we argued that it could be done in 10 to 12 months. But let me spend a few seconds addressing the question of is it a good thing to do at the present time? In fact, we would argue now more than ever it's important to set a date, because this is the one thing that all of the factions in Iraq agree on, and we need to bring them together. We also feel that by setting a specific date to get out, you will motivate the government in Iraq to do what they need to do to bring about meaningful reconciliation. A lot of people have argued that if you set a date to get out now, you will undermine the gains that have occurred in the last year and a half. In our view, it's exactly the opposite. If you don't set a deadline, you will, in fact, undermine those gains, because if the sons of Iraq, or the people who've been part of this awakening movement that started in Al Anbar province, think that the United States will be there indefinitely, they will no longer cooperate with us. In fact, as we point out in the report, and we've got quotations from a Marine general up there saying it was really after the 2006 election, when it became clear the United States would not be there forever, that this awakening movement took off. Similarly, you've probably seen the reports that Muqtada al-Sadr has said as long as there's a date for the Americans to get out, he will keep laying his arms down. Similarly, when you set a withdrawal date, it's going to give you much more leverage with the countries in the region to work together to ensure that Iraq does not become a failed state. Now, let me spend a couple of seconds before I turn it over to our panelists talking about how to get out. Now, if you've been following the news, Martha Raddatz, who's made innumerable trips to Iraq, on her last visit there, quoted two high-ranking officials who said, no, you couldn't get out in, 16 months, 24 months. It just can't be done. Well, we disagree. If you look at the arguments for people who say you can't get out in a comparatively short period of time, there's a couple of motivations there. One, they don't want to get out. They really want to stay, so they argue that it can't be done. The other is that they talk about the fact that there's not enough seaports in Kuwait to get the material out. Our feeling is once you get to Kuwait, then you can worry about it. You'll be out of Iraq. And they also want us to take out every piece of equipment that you have. I mean, even including the porta-johns. And again, our feeling is that you should take out the vital equipment. Now, how can you do it? Well, you can begin by not replacing the units as their 12 months or 15 months expires. You can take the troops out of the most stable areas. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over. We have a video here. If Alex can come up and help me do this thing, that'll show you exactly how to do that. But while we're getting ready, let me point out one thing. When people talk about the problems in logistics, remember that in the spring of 2004, we put in and out 235,000 troops and their equipment. So, Alex, if you would.
The first American units to withdraw would be the two regimental combat teams of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force currently deployed in Anbar Province. Next, Army units will be gradually withdrawn from Baghdad and its southern belts at a rate of 2 brigades per month. One brigade, the 1st Brigade of the 4th Infantry Division, will shift up to Diyala in order to allow the 2nd Stryker Cavalry Regiment to withdraw when its 15-month tour is complete in January 2009. Once the brigades in and around Baghdad are withdrawn, the brigades in northern Iraq, where the last remnants of extremist groups like Al-Qaeda in Iraq are located, will also be gradually withdrawn. Once the last brigade from northern Iraq has departed, the final American combat brigade, the 4th Brigade of the 1st Cavalry Division, currently performing route security duties, will depart Iraq.
Thank you. All right, now let me turn it over to two people who really know what they're talking about, Colonel Homs and Lieutenant Colonel Nagel. Both of them are Academy graduates, one from the Naval Academy, one from West Point. They're both war veterans. Colonel Homs has been in Somalia and in Iraq, and Colonel Nagel participated in both Gulf Wars, the first Persian Gulf War as well as the second. They're both scholars. They both, interestingly enough, have PhDs from Oxford. And they're both authors of a number of books and articles, and let me just mention a couple. Colonel Homs' book is called The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. Colonel Nagel's book is called, and I love this title, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Counterinsurgency Lessons from Malaya and Vietnam. And Colonel Nagel was also on the writing team that produced the Army's new counterinsurgency manual. So, Colonel Homs, if I can ask you to make a few comments.
Thank you very much. This is an interesting and difficult paper to evaluate. There's a continuing argument here, and we kind of are joining in the middle. This paper is an argument against the we can't withdraw quickly people. And frankly, the we can't withdraw quickly people have made a dishonest argument. It's just flat out dishonest. It will not take 3 to 4 years to get the equipment out of Iraq. That's not true. And this paper essentially destroys that argument. The problem is I wish you'd written a paper you kind of briefed, where the front hand half of the paper is the much more important part on what do we have a timeline or don't we have a timeline. The problem, I have two major problems with the paper. The first is that it's essentially an operational plan without a strategic concept. You gave the strategic concept at the beginning, and that needed to be part of the paper unless it's part of a series and I've missed the front end of it. The second thing is that we've got Washington, D.C. planners trying to conduct operational and tactical level planning. Concepts can be done from here. Operational and tactical level planning need to be left in theater. And this may be, frankly, in response to you've got an argument from the Kant side that says I've got to move every piece, so you've got to investigate down to that level to say you can. But starting with problem one, the conclusion at the end of the summary, the introduction says, the time for half measures and experiments is over. It is now time for a logistically sound strategic redeployment. So the strategic decision has been made by the paper without an argument. Now, as you go in at the very end of the paper, the conclusion is much less radical where it discusses the diplomatic, political, and military steps that must be taken first. We need an expansion on that if I'm going to buy into that we got to go now. The body of the paper is, in fact, titled The Strategy, Phase Consolidation. This implies that phase consolidation is agreed upon strategy when, in fact, it's really an operational technique to disengage. And I would rather see a more discussion of the point you made about is the timeline valid or not. That's the central argument, and that's the important argument, and you introduced it very well in the piece in there. Any kind of a decision like this has to be based on conditions that affect the strategic situation, not just in Iraq, but in the region. And you discussed that again in the beginning of the introduction. The paper, unfortunately, assumes a timeline is the single condition. Again, it seems to be in response to an ongoing argument. It never asks what our strategic goals in Iraq are, nor how we might achieve them. It simply assumes the goal is to get the troops out. And it states those who oppose the short timeline do so purely because of the argument it'll take more time to get the gear out. Now, there's a lot of people, including myself, who oppose that type of withdrawal, but it's not based on the gear. Frankly, at the cost, we could walk away from the gear, and we've done that before. The gear is not an issue really at all. Problem two, the paper plans down the brigade level. The basic rule in operational planning is think down two, write down one. So if you're a core headquarters, you think down to brigade, because the brigades are what the divisions have to move. So you think down two levels, but you don't tell that division commander what he's going to do with those brigades. You write his mission based on your understanding of what they can do. Let him figure it out. And the rule is simple enough that even at the next level headquarters, you don't know enough about the conditions two levels down to plan for that level. Despite all the fantasy of network centricity and a flattened battlefield, that in fact is not true. The other problem I have with the paper is it doesn't mention the other nations involved, the allies, or the contractors. Remember, we got almost as many contractors in that place as we got troops. How do we get them out, particularly since in many cases they're the logistic plug that supports the troops? So we've got to figure that out. And the only contingency planning is kind of a vague wave at the embassy security with the MU at the airport. Again, I don't think it's appropriate for national-level planners to decide what is an appropriate response force there. What you do is task them what the mission is. Do you provide close security for the embassy and against what kinds of threats? And this is a problem that started when the war started. We had people sitting across the river in the Pentagon deciding how many brigades the commanders on the ground would need and fundamentally where those brigades would go. And again, this is one of the real dangers of information technology is that we begin to get and think that because we can see through a soda straw, we understand. So in conclusion, it suffers from the two major problems of our original plan to go into Iraq in that it's based on a vision. We have to get out quickly and Iraq remains stable and peaceful. That is an arguable vision. It makes no provision for what to do if the vision is wrong. Suppose, for instance, they don't greet us with flowers. We had that problem before. We say that they'd probably be happy to see us go. That is probably true. But Aden was very happy to see the British go, and yet there was a tremendous bloodletting at the very end for the simple reason everybody wanted bragging rights to say they were the guys who drove the British out. So you got to kill a few of them on the way out. The other one we don't consider is the reignited civil war, which is frankly by far the most dangerous threat. It contains no discussion of how neighboring nations may react and no consideration of the wider strategic situation. In short, the paper does what it planned to do in terms of the ongoing argument. It totally demolishes a false argument. The logistics mean it will require years to get out of Iraq. I think the paper completely demolishes that. But the situation has changed dramatically since that argument started, and John, I think, is going to tell you in his talk exactly how dramatically. So in light of the new conditions, we need to get on with the discussion of our strategic goals in the region and how best to achieve them. And this discussion about whether it is timeline-based or not is valid as it applies to our goals in the region. Thank you very much.
John? Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be here with a man I've admired for many years, Larry Korb, and my old friend T.X. Hammes. And in my own life, T.X. has been sort of like the sand in the oyster that produces pearls. And certainly my hope is that today he's played that role with this paper, the Center for American Progress Report, How to Redeploy. And the paper states correctly that the security situation in Iraq is dramatically improved from a year ago, and I'd like to start off by talking about that from my own experience. I've just returned from 10 days on the ground in Iraq, not quite back a week here. Two of my battle buddies on that trip, Colin Call and Sean Brimley, I think, are in the audience, and I'm hoping they will correct my mistakes and my misperceptions. Our trip included battlefield circulation in Baghdad, Mosul, and Basra. The only place we didn't get was out west to Ramadi, my old stomping grounds. We spent a fair amount of time with General Petraeus, Ambassador Crocker, and also a pretty good amount of time with Iraqi citizens, including some politicians. And I'd like to begin with my impressions from the front. Attacks in Baghdad are down to four a day. Two of the days we were in Baghdad, there were no attacks in that city. Dora Market in Baghdad, once a war zone, is now a recovering war zone. There's a thriving gym with gym membership, a waiting list to get into the gym, and surreally Arnold Schwarzenegger posters on the walls from an earlier day. The Rashid Bank was open and conducting lots and lots of transfer payments. And interestingly, the person in charge, there was a male manager, but the deputy manager clearly in charge. She was a woman wearing a very flashy costume, jewelry, earrings, no abaya, and she had things to do and talk to us a little bit, but really wanted to take care of her customers. Fascinatingly, we saw at least a half a dozen jewelry stores open, and there is no better sign of security in place than jewelry stores open. Obviously, very easy snatch and grab, less security on those than we see in lots of jewelry stores here. And importantly, the market was protected not just by the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police, but also by the sons and daughters of Iraq, who were Sunnis who volunteered to fight with us against al-Qaeda in Iraq in late 2006 in what is now clearly one of the turning points of the war. So Baghdad and Basra are better, to alliterate. Mosul is still in the midst of a running gunfight. The two battalion commanders in Mosul, Keith Barclay and Chris Johnson, are both personal friends of mine. We got to spend some time with them. They are fighting against al-Qaeda, and Larry correctly noted that that will be the hopefully will be the last place we have to do this in Iraq. I would contend that withdrawing too soon increases the chances that we won't finish the job. Chris and Keith fighting a tough fight even as we speak. So many things are better. The sons and daughters of Iraq matter. The Iraqi army much better. But the Iraqis are not ready to take over security themselves, and at least in private, they'll admit that. Campbell Robertson had a very good New York Times piece on August 6th last week, and the title was, "The Iraqi Army is Willing but Not Able to Fight." And I disagree with the title a little bit. I would add the word alone. The Iraqi Army is willing and able to fight, but not yet by itself. And Lieutenant Colonel Mohammad Najim Kariri, an officer in the 3rd Battalion of the Iraqi Army's 19th Brigade, said, quote, "We are too many years behind other countries. We need the coalition forces until 2015. And I think that's probably about right. The Iraqi attack that cleared Basra of Jaish al-Mahdi in April would almost certainly have failed without American advisors and close air support. It was toppling on the edge of failure. And I fear that the proposal in this paper for a rapid withdrawal of all American forces would cause the collapse of the Iraqi security forces. And I'd like to disagree a little bit with Larry on the origins of the awakening and what happened there. And I'm going to refer to an excellent military review paper, from March-April of this year, Anbar Awakens, The Tipping Point, by Major Neil Smith, a friend of mine, and Colonel Sean McFarland. McFarland was the commander of the Ready First Combat Brigade, which was present in Ramadi when the turnaround happened, but when we cemented down the turnaround. And Neil and Colonel McFarland state, "Instead of telling the Sunni sheikhs that we would leave soon and they must assume responsibility for their own security, we told them we would stay as long as necessary to defeat the terrorists. That was the message they had been waiting to hear. As long as they perceived us as mere interlopers, they dared not throw in their lot with ours. When they began to think of us as reliable partners, their attitudes began to change." And I would argue that that statement is supported by a great amount of counterinsurgency literature, which points out that a counterinsurgency campaign is a struggle for the support of the population. And the population often would prefer to have the government forces take control. In general, they are less likely to commit human rights abuses. They are more likely to promote economic development. However, the insurgent forces have the extraordinary advantage of being able to come into their houses at night and slit their throats. And so until you get to the point that the families, the population, feels secure enough to throw in their lot with the counterinsurgent forces, they will lend at least tacit support, unwilling support. Stuart Harrington's great book about Vietnam, Silence Was a Weapon. Silence is a weapon in these kind of fights. So you've got to provide enough security that the people are willing to side with you and they believe you're going to stick it out for the long haul. And I think we've accomplished that in a lot of places in Iraq. Mosul, still not quite enough boots on the ground to protect the people, to make the people feel secure against the AQI presence in that city. And that message is really the message we received, Colin, Sean, I, the folks we were traveling with, from every Iraqi we talked to. They absolutely want America to leave, but not yet and not soon. The opinion was especially strikingly conveyed in a meeting we attended at the headquarters of the Mithal al-Alusi Party in Karada. This is a secular political party. They pulled 75 people into the leader of the party's office, and we had this impromptu sort of seminar on Iraqi and American politics. Fascinating. They were very, very concerned that America is going to withdraw too quickly, that we're not going to be able to cement the security goals. They believe that were that to happen, Iraq would fall back into the situation it just was. And frankly, I promised them that I would do everything I could to prevent that from happening. And I think one of the disagreements I have with the paper is a differing assessment of the capacity, the capability, and the driving factors behind the Iraqi government. The paper suggests, quote page 4, the reason the Iraqi government has not made satisfactory progress toward national reconciliation nor implemented critical power or revenue-sharing laws is because they are absent an incentive to truly take over their own affairs. And in fact, it's my belief that at least as significant a reason for Iraq's lack of political progress and slower military progress than in some ways this paper suggests, it's not a lack of will as much as it is a lack of capacity. For the 37 years of Saddam Hussein's rule, initiative was ruthlessly squashed in Iraq. Democracy, while freeing talent, has not eradicated 40 years of neglect of human capital. Put simply, the Iraqis don't know how to run a government. We were told that it takes more than a dozen signatures, culminating in the approval of a 3-star general to release Humvee tires to an Iraqi platoon that needs them. So this is a government that is still mired in bureaucracy, has numerous checks in which no one is willing to make a decision, and it's going to take a while for them to learn how to do those things, and I believe we can help them do that. But the fact that it will take a while for Iraq to get its affairs in order politically doesn't mean that we have to maintain a large American combat force there indefinitely. A roadmap to a different solution was provided to us by Colonel Dominic Caracillo, a brigade commander in the 101st Airborne, whose men patrol what used to be called the Triangle of Death, but is now only half mockingly called the Triangle of Love. Attacks there are down from 50 a week a year ago to only a couple a week now, and many of those are pretty ineffective, small pop-and-drop improvised explosive devices, although there's no such thing as a small IED when it goes off on you. Caracillo is implementing a drawdown of American forces in which a transition task force will replace his brigade. The task force won't conduct counterinsurgency itself, but will support the newly expanded 17th Division of the Iraqi Army. Its commander, who we met with, Major General Ali, has his challenges. He's short on body armor and helmets, and he'd sure like some of his own artillery so that he doesn't have to rely on ours. But as Colonel Caracillo says, Ali's forces are good enough for the enemy they have to face. I believe they are, as long as we continue to support them with advisors, air support, intelligence assets, and a steadily diminishing number of U.S. combat units partnered with and in support of Iraqi Army and police units. Iraq faces real threats both from inside and outside its borders, and I believe the United States has a long-term interest in helping it defeat and deter those threats. In my opinion, the most effective way to accomplish these national objectives is to conduct, as the paper says, a responsible phased withdrawal of U.S. combat troops from Iraq. But I believe that process won't take 10 months, but is likely to take a period of years, with a gradually decreasing number of U.S. combat forces and an increasing emphasis on U.S. advisors. Counterinsurgency is messy and slow, and there are no fast or easy answers, no matter how much we'd like there to be.
Thank you both. The interesting thing is when we asked the two colonels to comment on the paper, both of them said, we disagree. So I said, that's what we want, to have a good discussion, and they certainly made the case. Let me respond to a couple of things that have been raised, because I think they are very critical points that we need to be aware of. Colonel Hahn's point about no strategic plan, I tried in the front to summarize the reasons for it, and we referred to some of the other publications we put out. We put out a place called Strategic Reset, and I summarized that in the last paragraph, basically saying that until you get out of Iraq, you will not be able to deal with the problems in the greater Middle East. I also pointed out in here, and I think it's important, and again, the strategic thing is these arguments have been summarized so many times. Well, nobody talks about the cost of our remaining in there in terms of what it does and what it prevents us from doing using our hard and soft power in other places around the world, not paying attention to or not having the resources to deal with the situation in Afghanistan, what it's doing to our army in terms of the people that it's able to attract when the American people have turned against the war. And, you know, if you read Aaron David Miller's new book where he talks about the United States is not liked, not feared, nor respected in that part of the world, I believe you will not, until you get out of Iraq be able to do that. And so that's pretty much a part of the strategic thing that we're talking about, that it will actually enhance American security. The other thing is that as long as we're there, we're empowering Iran. And Iran will not work with us until we set a date to get out to ensure that Iraq becomes stable. People forget that Iran was very helpful to us in Afghanistan until they got put on the axis of evil. And so they simply do not trust us, and I don't think you can until you set a date, they will. The other thing is that this is the one thing the Iraqis agree on. The Iraqis want us out, and as long as that government is seen as a creature of the U.S., I don't think it's going to able to be effective. So I think in terms of the strategy, it would actually enhance our security, and we have talked about that in other publications. Now, let me get to a couple of things that John talked about in terms of the capacity of the Iraqi government. I agree. In fact, I was sent over there last year by the National Academy of Public Administration, you know, to meet with them to talk about the capacity of the Iraqi government. There's no doubt about the fact that it's hard to get things done. But we're not talking about capacity here. You take, for example, that much heralded provincial election law, okay? You know, the president of Iraq vetoed it, okay? And then the parliament adjourned without, you know, taking up action on it. So that was supposed to occur in October. It will not occur, you know, maybe, you know, next year. And this is what I'm talking about. They have no incentive as long as we're there to be able, to move quickly. The Iraqi security forces, I agree with that article in the New York Times, they can't defend themselves against an external enemy. But for heaven's sakes, there's 600,000 of them there. They can't deal with 20,000 insurgents. The problem in Basra was they deserted on the way in. That's why they had to call us in. It wasn't a question of them not having the capacity to do it. And I think this is, you know, you've got members of the Iraqi security forces who have more training than some of the young men and women we're sending over there to deal with this. So this question about they're not ready for what? And we have argued in the past that when you get out, you don't leave the region. And we pointed that out in here. You'll still be there if there's a major conventional invasion. And again, I think, you know, in terms of the awakening, we have a quote in here from Major General John Allen, the Marine commander in Al-Anbar. And he said, the election in 2006 did not go unnoticed. They talked about it all the time. He went on to say that the Marines in Anbar from top to bottom reinforced the message sent by the 2006 election by saying, we are leaving. We don't know when we're leaving, but you don't have much time to better get after this. And that, to me, was the key thing. And I think that when you look at that, that was the big turning point in all of the problems we have was the sons of Iraq and the so-called Iraqi awakening. Now, we make a comment in here about the surge, and, you know, I don't want to get into all of the arguments about the surge, but the fact of the matter is violence is down, and John pointed it out. The question is, are you going to take care of it? And I haven't been to Iraq and talked to all the people you have. I, you know, sit home, but I got a quote from a lieutenant in the 2nd Infantry Battalion of the 4th Brigade, 10th Mountain Division. That was in Salon.com. He said, if there's ever been a time to withdraw American troops, now's the time. Since I've been here, nobody has shot at me, and I haven't shot at anybody, so why not capitalize on this? So with that, if you guys have any comments, if not, we can turn over to the...
Okay. This is a discussion we should be having at the strategic level, rather than timeline and withdrawing. The concept that the Iranians oppose us because we're there, I think, misunderstands. I absolutely agree. Iran was very helpful in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then for some reason, we threw them onto the axis of evil. I don't know if we needed somebody to round out the threesome or what the hell the logic on that was, but the logic escapes me. They fear a destabilized Iraq. They make the point that they lost more people to the Iraq invasions of the 80s than at any time since Genghis Khan passed through. So they're very attuned to this and are willing to cooperate with us. My concern is that If we withdraw and instability starts, which there's still a high probability, not the insurgency. Frankly, the insurgency doesn't worry me. It is civil war, which, remember, we had transitioned from insurgency to a nearly full-blown civil war before this got over. That can reignite. If that reignites, Iran will enter. As far as not being able to do anything in the Middle East until we're out, if we pull out and it collapses, we have zero credibility, and rightfully so. We've gone in, we kicked over the ash can, and we left. You may have noticed I don't think the plan to go into Iraq was particularly a good idea, nor was it well executed. So you had a bad idea poorly executed, and now we are where we are. I think that if we do the sudden withdrawal, we're going back along that route. We're taking a look without a significant study of the strategic impact, and we're assuming we're going to get certain results. What I don't see is the branch plans and the sequels, where a branch plan is we're starting down a path and something happens that we didn't anticipate. And so you have a plan ready to operate in that condition. A sequel is it goes as we plan. Now what do we do? And you've got a bit of that with the we keep forces in the Middle East. But I'm happy we're having more of this discussion and less of the mechanical discussion of how to get out.
Okay. John?
Great. Let me talk to the question of the Army being under strain, which it absolutely is. But let me also say that morale among the troops and among my friends is far higher in 2008 than it was a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. The change in attitude is palpable. The guys can tell we're winning. Even the guys in Mosul who are engaged in a tough gunfight know that they are winning that tough gunfight. So although the Army is working hard and you know, for God's sake, if you see a guy in uniform, buy him a beer, he deserves it. Morale of the Army is, in my opinion, improving, not going down. Larry mentioned the need to send additional forces to Afghanistan. I concur with that completely, and the Office of the Secretary of Defense is engaged in a tough balancing act now, trying to figure out how quickly they can withdraw forces from Iraq while preserving security gains there and preserving American interests both in Iraq and in the region while simultaneously sending more badly needed troops to Afghanistan. Just at least as important as the additional combat brigades we're going to send to Afghanistan is the increase in the size of the Afghan National Army. What we've seen in Iraq recently is a payoff on a long-term investment in the Iraqi security forces that started under Major General Eaton, who had TX work for him for a month before he got smart, I think. But that started way back in 2004, and it takes a long time to build an army. It's easy to disband. It's hard to build. And what we've got to do is the same long, slow process that we did in Iraq, we've got to do in Afghanistan. Secretary Gates last week announced a doubling or near doubling of the size of the Afghan National Army, exactly what we need to do. But again, it's going to take a while for that investment to pay off.
Politics can be serious business, but sometimes you really just do have to have a little bit of fun with it, which is why we bring you your weekly campaign trivia quiz. This week, the term First Lady is a loaded one. Frankly, Jackie Kennedy said she hated the term, as have many other First Ladies in history, which brings us to the question, who was the First Lady in history? We know that Martha Washington, for example, was never called the First Lady, nor was Abigail Adams, and that's a hint. Those two ladies are not the answer. So today's question was, when was the term First Lady used for the very first time, and in reference to which wife of a presidential candidate? Extra points if you can come up with an answer for what will we call the first man? This is Christy Harvey and John Neuroer, and you're listening to The Progressive Beat. And there's a lot of serious campaign news going on right now, but it's time to take you into some of the headlines that maybe you haven't seen in what we like to call paparazzi politics. And the first story that I have is, this is very interesting. You see a lot of these celebrities who love to come out, love to get involved in politics. They like to say that Washington, D.C. is Hollywood for ugly people, but I swear that the pretty people in Hollywood really like to get politically involved. And there's always a lot of debate over whether or not it means anything. If you have Chuck Norris going on the stump for you, does it mean anything? If Angelina Jolie says she's voting for you, or if that Heidi chick from The Hills says she's voting for you, does it actually mean anything? And, you know, it's easy to blah, 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 talk about it. But two economists from the University of Maryland decided to go mathlete on us and crunch the numbers and find out. They went through tons of elections, looked at all of the celebrity supporters, and when it comes down to it, nah, celebrity endorsements don't really have much sway with voters. They don't really give you much bump in the polls unless you get the Oprah.
Yeah.
Oprah Winfrey's the only
Naturally.
One. And when they crunch the numbers, it turns out if Oprah Winfrey supports your candidacy, you're looking at an extra 1 million votes.
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching.
Not Heidi from the hills.
Move over, you know, Cal Penn from Harold and Kumar. Move over John Cusack. The only celebrity endorsement that really matters at the end of the day is the Oprah.
Well, I have one that's a quick one, and Christy talked earlier about the situation in Georgia and the conflict with Russia. Well, John McCain and Barack Obama both quickly had to whip together something on this issue, a speech or something, and apparently John McCain was doing it at the very last minute, sort of like a college term paper, and derived, so it seems, a lot of his speech on Georgia, at least the first one that he gave at the end of last week, from Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
And he didn't cite his source. Wonder why. So a Wikipedia editor called Political Wire to point out that there were a lot of similarities between John McCain's speech and the Wikipedia article on the country of Georgia. And there were a number of instances where it was basically what you did when you were in college and you went to the encyclopedia and you copy-pasted and you changed three words and handed it in and you didn't get caught.
Or if you go even more old school, not to date me, but it's also like when I was growing up and you would have a report on the heart and you would run home and get out your World Book encyclopedia set and furiously scribble down everything in there.
Yeah.
So before cut and paste, I guess.
Yeah, oops.
Where do you shop, by the way?
Where do I shop?
If I gave you a choice, let's go shopping.
Okay.
And we can either go to Filene's, Target, JCPenney's or Sears. Where would you go?
I would go to Target or JCPenney, probably.
I love Target. But it says a
love
lot
Target,
about
RJ.
How you're going to vote.
Really? So what does that say about me?
I'm obsessed with micro-targeting. And micro-targeting is when you find a little teeny piece of someone's daily routine and you can extrapolate it to find out who they're going to vote for. And we've talked before on the show, you know, way back in the past about, for example, fried chicken. If you get your fried chicken from Popeyes, you're more likely to vote Democratic. If you get your fried chicken from KFC, you're more likely to be a Republican. I think that's fascinating. So there's a new
or crazy
a new poll out from John Zogby, and they looked into retail politics and basically said where you shop, does it have any influence, or are you more likely to shop at certain stores depending on your political affiliations? So they looked at who people were voting for, where they were shopping.
Okay, I would have chosen Target if I had to pick one.
Then it looks like, and I'm not going to ask you your personal politics, but it looks like you would probably be an Obama supporter. Obama supporters, 53% of people who shop at Target were supporting Barack Obama, while 29% were supporting John McCain.
Interesting.
The largest split was Filene's Basement. 59% of people who shopped regularly at Filene's Basement were Obama supporters, while only 24% were backing John McCain. Now, if you wanted to see the split on the other side, it turns out Walmart is for John McCain. So Target Obama,
shocker,
Walmart,
right?
John McCain. 33% of Walmart shoppers said that they were supporting Barack, while 47% said that they were supporting John McCain. And then the biggest McCain split was Sears.
Sears.
Which I thought was particularly interesting because I can't remember the last time I was in a Sears. I didn't know that they still had Sears. But I guess they do. And 32% of Obama voters or of Sears shoppers are looking to support Barack Obama in 2008, while a whopping 46% are going for John McCain. So
I mean,
watch.
I see Walmart, right? I see Walmart. I can understand that. But Sears just seems to me kind of apolitical, doesn't it? You would think.
Well, you would think same with Target, so...
I don't know. Target's kind of French, and that's what
right? That's why I just think it's so interesting,
Target.
Because, you know, who knew that the place you choose to go buy charcoal and a pair of tube socks, you know, is going to tell these micro-targeters so much about your inner political psyche?
Who knew? It's kind of creepy, to be honest. All right, this is a quick hit from Crazy Town. So this is Dateline Crazy Town. Jeremiah Wright, You remember him?
Everybody
Oh, yes. Does, naturally. This is perfect timing, maybe, if you would say perfect. In October, Jeremiah Wright's new book will be coming out. He will be going on a book tour, according to New York Magazine. So October and the significance, Jeremiah Wright, maybe. Seems like maybe someone's bankrolling this book tour effort.
And there you have it.
There you have it. For all these stories and more, check out micheckradio.org. For Christy Harvey, I'm John Neurer. You're listening to The Progressive Beat. You're listening to The Progressive Beat. This is John Neurer. And if 2008 is the year of the youth vote, then I have someone here who is representing for that youth vote, Tanya Paperny. Tanya, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tanya is the Advocacy Associate at Campus Progress. So, Tanya, everybody's talking about this being the year of the youth vote, and Campus Progress and Campus Progress Action are trying to capitalize on all this excitement. So, first of all, can you tell me a little bit about Campus Progress and Campus Progress Action?
Sure, definitely. Well, basically, Campus Progress, we're a nonprofit based out here in DC, and we have a sister affiliate organization, Campus Progress, where we do some more of the voting and legislative activity. But basically, Campus Progress works to kind of empower young people through three different programs: journalism, activism, and events. So, in terms of journalism, we have a web magazine that's all written by young people, really awesome stuff, all, you know, politics, arts, culture, whatnot. And we support about 50 student publications across the country. We give them grants and trainings to keep up and running their awesome alternative magazines. Events, we bring speakers and films to campuses for free all across the country. And we also bring 1,000 young people to D.C. every year for our huge national conference to basically, you know, help network young progressives. And then in terms of campus events, you know, just keep the debate going and making sure that young people are shaping the debate through hard-hitting events. And then in terms of activism, we give grants and training to students doing campaigns on their campuses or in their communities, anywhere from folks doing sustainability campaigns to anti-death penalty work to, you know, LGBT activism, just all across the spectrum of progressive activism. And we also do national issue campaigns on ending the war, climate change, stuff like that. And then Campus Progress Action, our sister affiliate, does some other stuff, Pushback, our blog, and our big thing right now is I'm Voting For.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more specifically about I'm Voting For. Now, that's a project of Campus Progress Action, and that's sort of your more election-centric Web 2.0, you might say, kind of project. Can you talk to us a little bit about what I'm Voting For is?
For sure. So basically, I'm Voting For, as the name suggests, we're talking to people about what they're voting for. And
that makes sense.
What the avenue through which we're doing this is an online video testimonial project. Basically, people are talking about the youth vote, and so are we. We're working with a ton of young people, but we wanted to make sure that people were actually talking about it in a way that was productive and really talking about the issues that young people care about, and not necessarily the candidate that's driving them to the polls, but the important issues that are really impacting this generation that are oftentimes the reasons that they're actually turning out. So what we decided to do is create a campaign where we could get videos from young people all across the country basically talking about the personal issues, personal experiences that they care about the most, and how that's translating into driving them to the polls in November. So we already have a website up there, imvotingfor.org, and you can check out already hundreds of videos from young people all across the country. And then we're starting to send these out to the media to basically get them to talk about the issues that young people really care about.
So bottom line, what is the one large goal of this project? So it's great to have all these videos and put them all in one place and tell, you know, the media and tell candidates that young people have, you know, are this issue or that issue is important to them. But what's the one main goal that you have putting together this project I'm Voting For?
I'd say the main goal is to kind of dispel this myth that the reason young people are turning out, especially this year, is because of a particular candidate or set of candidates. We think the reason young people are turning out in record numbers is because they're saddled with some really, really crucial issues that, if not addressed, the consequences are going to hit young people the hardest. And kind of the ways we're addressing this main goal, one is essentially media reform, trying to get you know, the media to talk about issues in a substantive way rather than kind of shallow conversations about some sort of superficial difference between the candidates.
Sure.
Another is youth engagement by sort of empowering young people to be able to literally put their voices on the internet with no filter to see that they can therefore then, you know, make a difference. Some of these videos have already been featured in various media outlets. And then kind of the other way we're trying to achieve this goal is actually sending these video to the candidates. You know, these are the issues young people actually care about. How are you planning on addressing
it? So what are some of those issues? What are you finding are some of the most important issues to young voters in this election cycle?
Basically, you know, we didn't come at it with a certain set of pre-notions about what we thought young people were going to be talking about. Obviously, we're a progressive organization. We have national issue campaigns on certain issues. But what we found out that young people care about, and basically the way we found out about this is that we upload videos from young people we meet all across the country. People can actually upload themselves from their own home computers on YouTube, and they just tag the issue that they're talking about in the video, and so the site automatically creates a category of top 10 issues the young people are talking about. And across the board, every week on the site, the top 10 issues among them are issues like the economy, especially college affordability, climate change, and the war in Iraq. And also, you know, in international relations in general, America's foreign policy, and civil rights a lot, too. And that covers folks talking about affirmative action, racial equality, LGBT rights, you know, wiretapping, stuff like that. And basically, you know, what we found is that a lot of these people are talking about issues that the media might already be talking about, but they're kind of overlooking the particular angle of that issue that overwhelmingly affects young people.
From the youth perspective.
Exactly.
Right.
The war in Iraq, it's largely people 18 to 21 dying. The economy, young people are probably, this generation, the first in a long time that's worse off than their parents. A lot of folks can't afford college or having to drop out or moving back home immediately after college. So these are the issues that overwhelmingly keep coming back up on the site as the most important issues to young people.
Now, the youth vote was a huge story, especially in the primary, especially in the Democratic primary. A lot of people in media seem to attribute that to the excitement in the Barack Obama campaign for young people. Now, do you think for the general election, just specifically, are we going to see an increase in youth voter turnout in the general election as compared to 2000 or 2004? A lot of people, you know, especially in the 2000 cycle and 2004 cycle, this was the story leading up, that the youth vote could make the difference, that there actually is going to be, you know, this huge turnout of young voters. And in the end, that just wasn't the case. While it may be a little bit higher than average in 2000 and 2004, it just wasn't this explosion of youth vote that a lot of pundits were talking about. Do you think 2008 is different? And if so, why is that?
I think it's absolutely different. I think, you know, first of all, the 2008, the primaries for this election, young people did turn out in really record numbers in states where they, you know, had never done so before. So that you know, the way people were predicting it exceeded their predictions. And I think turnout for the general election for young people is going to definitely exceed people's expectations. There's a couple reasons I think that's happening. Yeah, they were talking about it in 2000, 2004. And basically what's changed is that a lot of campaigns, local campaigns, national campaigns, are starting to realize that youth vote is definitely something to keep, you know, to give full attention to. So
right.
They're hiring youth vote directors, they're hiring youth outreach directors, something that campaigns have never had before. Not only that, you know, it takes recognizing that voting bloc as something substantial, but also doing something to actually target them. So these positions are out there, you know, totally helping register young people to vote, because it's not always, you know, it's not always the easiest and most obvious thing to do. No one comes and knocks on your door when you turn 18 and tells you to register to vote.
Right.
A lot of other countries, like Canada, for example, you're automatically registered. So basically, a lot of these folks are doing voter registration campaigns. And I think if young people vote for the first time when they're 18, they're totally more likely to just keep voting for the rest of their lives. They get in a habit. Not only that, but, you know, programs like I'm Voting For and a lot of other folks out there, for the first time, the conversations about the candidates and about the election are often youth and user-driven. Programs like I'm Voting For, which is basically new media, online video testimonials, the content is pretty much the entire site. All the content is created by young people on the ground, users. All we did was, you know, create a platform.
Sure.
People can upload their own videos. So it's basically a really empowering experience where you see your own voice reflected in the debate. And so now it's not necessarily just the candidates or the media coming down and passing on some talking points and setting the debate and setting the stage for what people are talking about. It's actually YouTube videos being posted as questions during debates. It's people writing blogs, breaking news, stuff like that. So people are finally starting to see their voices reflected in the conversation. I think that's going to end up them turning out and seeing themselves as having a big stake in this election. The reason young people are turning out a lot of the times is the war.
Before we wrap up, tell me if young people want to get involved, how do they do it?
Check us out. Check out imvotingfor.org. Upload your own video, or if you're interested in getting involved as an activist or journalist or events planner with Campus Progress, our C3 affiliate, please do check out campusprogress.org. Learn about how to host free events on your campus, become a student representative for this upcoming school year, and start a student publication.
Tanya Paperny, Advocacy Associate at Campus Progress and Campus Progress Action. Thanks so much for
being
with us here on the Progressive Beat. Before we wrap up, the answer to this week's trivia question, to remind you once again what the question was, who was the first First Lady? The answer is Lucy Webb Hayes, wife of Rutherford B. Hayes. Lucy was referred to as the First Lady by Mary Clemmer Ames, who was a reporter for The Independent, a local news magazine. So, some fast facts about Lucy Webb Hayes. She was a graduate of Wesleyan Female College, and she actually, once Rutherford B. Hayes became president, banned alcohol from the White House. She also canceled the inaugural ball, and she had a no-smoking policy, and there were worship services twice a week. So, Lucy Webb Hayes, the first lady. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Beat. I'm John Neuroer. For Christy Harvey, please join us next week on the POTUS Station XM Channel 130.